Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who once described Caddyshack as an awesome documentary, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT underscore golf guy. This week is the second of two holiday weeks surrounding the 4th of July. First off, congrats to a couple of major champions crowned last weekend. First, in a playoff for the KPMG Women's PGA Championship, Sung Hyun Park won to claim her second career major. And in exciting fashion at the U.S. Senior Open at the Broadmoor in Colorado, this was really good theater down the stretch. David Toms outlasted Miguel Angel Jimenez, who birdied the 18th to what he thought get in a tie, and Jerry Kelly to claim his first major on the senior circuit. On today's show, we'll revisit a fantastic conversation with Chris Nashawaty of Entertainment Weekly magazine, who has written, in my opinion, the definitive book about the most beloved movie about golf ever, Caddyshack. However, we begin with a chat I had the other day with two former Big Break contestants, Christian Heavens and longtime friend of the show, Will Lowry. These two guys are more than just professional golfers trying to carve out a career on a tour. They're two African-American athletes trying to change athletics and the game for the better. All right, well, we've had enough of Lowry over the years. We'll get to him in a second. First time I've met, Christian, enjoyed your work on The Big Break. A lot of people wondering, well, you know, after you leave The Big Break, a lot of times people go, what happens to these guys? What have you been up to? Where you been? What's happening with you now?
Yeah, I've just been continuing the grind from, you know, that I was doing previous to The Big Break. Just wanted to follow up behind, you know, a lot of the great guys like Tony Finau, the Bryan brothers. You know, just a lot of guys have made it to the tour from The Big Break, and it's also motivated me, so I'm still on that pursuit to getting on tour. Nothing stopped since I left early for the show, from the show, but, you know, just keeping it going.
Now, the route that you chose to take, you went up to the Canadian tour. You had your card there for a year or so. You're sort of rehabbing from some injury now. What is life like on the minor leagues of professional golf? And I don't mean that term in a derogatory fashion whatsoever.
That's what it
but
is.
The web.coms, the PGA Tour South America, the McKenzie Tour, the Canadian Tour. What's your week to week life like?
Yeah, it's a grind and it's not glamorous. You know, you talk to a lot of people and let them know that you're a professional golfer and they're thinking of private jets around, staying in luxury hotels, playing the nicest courses. That's not quite the case at this level. We're staying at super rates or the cheapest thing on Priceline that we can do.
Oh, wait a minute. As we like to say, places Will Lowry would never stay.
Right. No.
I mean, if I can afford it, I'll drop them off.
If there's anyone that believes in a two bathrobe situation at a hotel, it's Will Lowry. He's not a grinder anymore.
No.
All right. All right. So you're doing the Super 8s. You're doing the budget thing.
Yeah, the budget thing and just trying to just keep going. Keep your head above water, whether that's, you know, skipping a meal here and there, sleeping forward to a hotel room, you know, being in a car, traveling with two buddies for 12 hours.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Do you have a group that you latch onto, a couple of guys, and y'all, you know, travel down the roads together?
Yeah, we got a really good group. Like a couple of guys that went to McKenzie Tour with, nearly a dozen guys that go on the Advocates Tour with. And we just travel week to week or tournament to tournament together just to cut costs and budget and push each other. And that's become my family. Like, I spend a lot of time on the road. So these guys that I'm with, I spend more time with them than my family. So they're pretty much my family, you know, in a way.
At that level, do you have caddies or can you afford caddies? Or do you wind up toting your own bag more often than not?
No, you tote your bag more often than not. But then you get to McKenzie Tour and you have to have a caddy. But you can't, unless you're sponsored and taken care of, you're not going to have your best friend or your guide, you know, travel with you week in, week out because you have to pay for their hotels and food. So just end up paying some local high school kid $30, you know, $30 a round, especially in Latin America. He barely speaks English. You guys can't communicate, but, you know, as long as he carries a bag before he gets you around the course.
Did you have a situation, though, where you did the local caddy route, whether it was in Canada or South America, where you're about halfway through a round going, holy, this kid really knows what he's doing. He's a good caddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you have a couple of those. I wouldn't say most of them just carry the bag and keep it
yeah,
going.
Yeah, but it's not like you found bones on
the... Right.
But
yeah, exactly.
The crazy part, so when I was in, when I had a tournament in Guatemala, And my caddy and I, we really couldn't communicate. So the best way he told me how to putt, he said, he gets a circle in his hand.
Yeah.
He said, well, huh. And so when he put his finger over the right part of his circle, self-made hand.
So that was right hand.
That was right hand. Yeah. And that right there, I said, man, it's so nut. And before you know it, I drained like three in a row. I was like, man, this is a genius.
Yeah.
And if I can afford it, man, I'd take you on the road with me, man.
Yeah. What you need is hand signals and grunts.
Right? Exactly.
The secret to putting. Will Lowry and Christian Heavens are our guests taking dead aim. All right. I always like to, before we get into what you're doing now, because you always got projects in the work, but my favorite thing that you do every year, Will, is I love flipping on the TV. It's that tournament at Lake Tahoe, the celebrity event. And what I always love is no matter who you're caddying for, whether it's Tim Brown, Jerry Rice, or whatever, somehow, some way, you get more camera time than they do.
I do.
It's amazing to me.
I do. And it got to the point to where Tim Brown, he allows me to have my silly moments. So he says, how long is it going to take before you get to the driving range? Because I'm going to be out there about 20 minutes. So before you know it, everybody, Jerome Best, like, here come the superstar. You know, you got Marcus Allen. Here come the Heisman Trophy caddy winner. You know, so before you know it, man, I guess I get a little camera time. I don't mind too much of it, though.
Those guys are still pretty intense, though. I think the last time we talked about it, you told me that there's not a more intense golfer anywhere in the world, any tour, than Marshall Faulk.
Marshall Faulk, I firmly believe he can play on a tour right now. So
he believes he could probably play on a tour right now.
Yeah, so, you know, before you know, we're kidding around, and like I said, he had me down to making a turn, and before you know it, he still hadn't cracked a smile. And then, so I'm like, man, you know, let me get serious. And as I started getting serious, I still couldn't get to him and beat him. So before you know it, on 18th hole, he had me down four, and I tried to play it off and lose a ball. I'm out of balls. So let's have a good time. So I can't officially sign my name on the scorecard.
Okay.
Well, Marshall Faulk, I'd like to play you if you're ever listening to this. We can play. Try your luck. Yeah,
and bring that wallet, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
right.
Load it down with the kind of cash that folds.
He'll do it.
You had a run-in with Samuel L. Jackson. Not a run-in.
Yes.
Like, you didn't, like, get involved.
Right.
But you came into contact with Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
Two of the biggest personalities in golf. You and Samuel L. How'd that happen?
So it was... So we... a friend of mine, Chris Spencer. Yeah, he's a comedian out in L.A. And he's always, like, a big brother to me. So he's like, hey, man, we're going to play golf this morning. I'm not going to tell you who we're playing with. So one of the usuals is Anthony Anderson. Anthony Anderson, he has a number one show on ABC called Black-ish. And so, you know, playing with Anthony is cool. Now he's running the mill. We play every day. We're fine. But he said, we're playing with somebody else. I'm like, who? So we get to, now when you as big as Samuel, you pretty much run the shots in the group. I want a tee time at 5:15 a.m. I want to be on the, I want to start on 10. So he gets what he wants. So we get there and I get to the parking lot. It's pitch dark and I'm not going to tell the car he had, but he had a nice car. And comes out, bucket hat, and this unique voice that everybody have heard all around the world. And I'm never really, you know, celebrity shocked, but I was kind of like, oh, it's Samuel Jackson.
And he has such a vocabulary that we really can't use.
Right. But it was used that day.
It was pretty spectacular, was it not?
Yeah, it was pretty good. And you know, I never felt so comfortable hearing the words that I was hearing, and I was like, oh, I heard that before. I said, oh man, this is music in my ears. It was pretty fun.
Do you think that Samuel L. has reached the level in playing golf that some people reach? I know I talked to a guy who wrote a book on Arnold Palmer, and he was telling a story about the one and only time that he could find that someone made Arnold Palmer pay for golf.
Really?
Quick aside, he had always heard about Bandon Dunes.
Uh-huh.
And so they hopped in, Arnold Palmer won, and jetted out to Oregon. And he had made a tee time. And, you know, he called the pro shop. You know, hey, this is Arnold Palmer. I'd like to play, whatever. And they took it. Okay, Arnold Palmer, 10 a.m. So in walks Arnold Palmer.
Wow.
Now, you would think that if you're running a pro shop and the man walks in.
The king himself.
Yeah. I mean, all that's missing is the crown and the flowing robes and the grace.
Right,
you know? And you would think that they would just say, Mr. Palmer,
we've got your cart, we've got your chauffeur. Uh-huh. You just tell us which one of our properties you want to play and you're on now. That guy said, oh, well, welcome, Mr. Palmer. Your group here? Great. That'll be $150 a piece.
No
man charged Arnold Palmer. And the author said that that was the first and last time that Arnold Palmer visited Band of Dudes.
Really?
So my question is, when was the last time do you think that Samuel L. Jackson had to pay for something in the game of golf?
I mean, he didn't pay for nothing that day. You know, and one quick story, we were all, after we played our round, you know, we had a discussion, you know, we had dinner or lunch or what have you, and it was pretty surreal. It was myself, I like to think I was probably one of the big guys there, key names, but it was myself, Anthony Anderson, Big Game James Worthy, and Samuel Jackson, and they were, and we, the conversation that was at that table, just talking about entertainment. Now, entertainment and sports kind of collide. It was pretty monumental.
Christian, top five people in the world that drop names better than Will Lowry.
Is Will Lowry, Will Lowry.
Yeah, I mean, we hadn't even heard about Big Game James Worthy from here in Gastonia, but he thought he'd just sort of slide that one in.
I had to put that one in there.
Two of my favorite guys from Big Break over the years, Christian Heavens and our friend Will Lowry, our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, before we talk about the project that we can't talk about, mm-hmm. one that interests me that you brought up that you two guys are working on is a show of some kind called Barriers. I think this is a great idea.
Yes. Yeah, we have a show, Barriers. I just got picked up by a production company called Lectus out in L.A. And basically just want to show the documentary of grassroots athletes as they get ready for the 2020 Olympic Games.
And these are in sports that African-American people are not necessarily known for.
Right. They lack diversity. You know, that's your fencing, your swimming, gymnastics, et cetera.
Do you have trouble finding someone who is into fencing, or do you have to recruit someone to get into
it? No, they're out there. You know, from me traveling, you know, and it's so funny, and I hate to put them in the category of rarity, but I remember I was at a Advocate Tour event where I was in Atlanta. And I was staying at a hotel, and there was a guy. It was a group of swimmers who were African American swimmers, and you know, where I'm sitting at the bar talking to them, and I was looking. I'm like, man, you guys exist, like a black swimmer. Like so now I
found a group of unicorns.
Right. So the white buffalo, you know. and so I'm poking them like, man, you're real. And so I get now where they say, hey, you know, I say I'm a professional golfer. They look at me the same way, and I say, man, I apologize for putting you in that category, right. but man, like you look. You're real, and you can swim too, you know. So it was kind of surreal.
So will you just pick a handful of athletes or a handful of sports and then just follow them?
We have a few that we're targeting. You know, some names who are somewhat kind of on the fence of breaking through, and some who are just literally working 9 to 5 and still trying to pursue their dream. So yeah,
can you imagine how? Because you know that around the world, these people are funded by their own countries. Yeah. You know, 24/7, 365. You got some guy who's you know, stocking shelves at Walmart from midnight to 6, sleeping for a couple of hours, hitting the pool.
And the thing is, you know, Christian can attest to it. You know, this time we go out to the driving range and we see the Swedish golf team come out in a beautiful van, fully clothed. Everybody has the same outfit, uniform, and all the beautiful clubs. And their country is kind of providing them access to try to succeed in over here. And
I like the visuals that you're able to create, Lowry. This is spectacular to me. Never would you run into, like, the Polish women's team.
No,
it's the Swedish bikini team that happens to play golf.
Yes.
And they just appear in this luxurious van, stepping off, all of them looking like Tiger Woods' ex-wife.
Yeah. They're aesthetically pleasing to the eyes. They're aesthetically pleasing.
Well, Will Lowry, Christian Heavens, our guest taking Dead Aim, of course, both of them first known as Big Break contestants. I want to talk about this show that we can't talk about, so we're not going to mention the name.
Yes.
You and I have talked about it off and on for the last several years.
Yes.
It looks like this is actually going to happen. This is coming to fruition.
Yeah. It's a show that kind of just wanted to basically document the stories of minority golfers who come from a different clubhouse, so to speak. And we've got a powerful production company behind it now, and got a big A-list name attached to it, and hopefully, you know, within the next, hopefully, our goal is to have cameras on the ground by 2019. We're hoping.
Where are we now with diversity and inclusion in the game of golf? Are we better off than we were 5 years ago? Are we making progress?
Well, I'm gonna let you answer the question. So, on the introductory level of golf, and now we're talking about first tee,
right?
Boys and Girls Club, United Way, the minority participation is 41%. On the competitive level of golf, as far as minority participation rate, as far as talking about collegiately, we're at 0.5%.
What happens? Where are we missing the boat? Where is the ball, not to use a pun, but where is the ball being dropped between introduction to the game and the first tee, which I volunteer at, my son volunteers an awful lot of time at. I really think it's a great program. And I see the diversity at that level.
I think Christian can attest to this, when I do my first tee engagement from, you know, border to border and coast to coast, I started to notice is that in each chapter, there's probably 2 to 3 minority golfers who are capable of playing at high level golf. That's your AJGA, your IJG Tour, Junior Hurricane Tour. And that's where college coaches are present to recruit for the following year. But the thing is that sometimes those kids aren't able to get to those particular AJGA tournaments.
Look.
Especially AJG.
I'm middle-class white America. Yeah. I can't get my kids to those tournaments.
There you go.
Okay? I mean, we're talking, if you don't know, Hurricane Tours and especially AJGA, it's kind of a closed shop, kids.
Right.
It's at least $1,000 a weekend.
Yeah.
And that includes tournament fees, that includes traveling, that includes hotels. Yeah. And I don't know how many of y'all are bleeding $1,000, but I'm sure not.
Right. No. Exactly. No. And that's the thing is where, you know, the myth, where hopefully we can, you know, point out and we can debunk the myth of that, you know, minority just not interested in the game of golf. And they are. It's just that just the access to play is where it's pretty difficult.
So I guess let me narrow my question here. Let's say first tee goes through sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then we start middle school.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we dropping the ball in middle school? Or is it just that the African American community just I love basketball more. I love football. I mean,
that's part of it too. I think there's the player development part. So the first tee is very good at the introduction stage. The first tee is very good at the introduction stage, and their job is just to introduce golfers to the game of golf, right? Or young juniors to the game of golf, and they give them, you know, the basic tips and the fundamentals. But you need a lot more than that to get to, you know, to be competitive and go to college. So we're missing programs like that really is directed to getting kids, you know, ready for a competitive level. And like you were saying, too, you know, AJGAs are expensive. And you, even for a middle-aged white man, it's still expensive for you. But the numbers for minorities,
I'm not trying to throw myself in the class.
It's not so much of a race thing as far as, I mean, it's just golf is expensive.
Expensive.
And, you know, the amount of minorities that can afford it. The numbers just drop so much.
And the thing with the first tee, no shade to the first tee. First tee is doing their job. They're introducing kids to the game of golf. And so you're not at, and the thing is, I don't want people to belittle first tee or downgrade them and say, hey, man, you know, they're not helping to grow the game. They are helping grow. They're doing what they're supposed to do, introduce kids to the game of golf.
But it's just that level after first tee is what we're missing.
That's right. Where we're missing. Yeah. And that's the thing that we're attacking. We got a foundation coming up that's going to attack those obvious barriers.
Well, that leads me to this final question. Get you out of here on this. Christian Heavens and Will Lowry, former Big Break contestants, now golf entrepreneurs, our guests taking Dead Aim. There was a lot of talk at the KPMG Women's PGA this last weekend about the advantages that the South Korean women's golfers have because of government funding.
Right.
And from the time they reach a certain age, they can just throw themselves into golf, and school is a supplement to golf, similar to, you know, what a Ledbetter Academy or IMG Academy is down in Bradenton, Florida.
Right.
Is that what we need to do? Is that a step that is possible?
Personally, I do. I think you know, when it comes to the game of golf, you know, it's that's already kind of taking place in the AAU basketball community. You know, if you find a kid who is pretty much solid in basketball, you realize that, you know, he's under somebody's wing. And quick story, there's a kid that I met in D.C. By a kid by the name Hakeem Jackson. Hakeem Jackson is a physical specimen, 6'2", maybe 175 pounds, at the age of 13. He hits the ball as pure as ice water when it comes to the game of golf. But he also is an exceptional basketball player and a great football player. And so he said something to me that almost brings tears to my eyes. He said, you know, Will, when I want to play football and basketball, I have coaches knocking on my door and giving me the latest equipment, the latest shoes, the latest helmet, shoulder pads. Mm. But when I want to play my favorite sport, golf, I can't find anybody. So that right there is pretty much, you know, the whole kit and caboodle of where we are and why we can't, I guess, say grow the game, is that so to speak? Or
why we're stifling ourselves.
Stifling ourselves. So it's this development, man, you know, just having these kids under a certain tutelage and watch them grow.
Will Lowry has long been one of my favorite people in golf, and it was great to meet former Big Break contestant Christian Heavens as well. Up next, we look back to a fascinating conversation with Entertainment Weekly's Chris Nashawaty about his book that takes dead aim at Caddyshack, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Chris Nashawaty is a movie critic with Entertainment Weekly. Earlier this year, we had the chance to speak about his new book, The Definitive Look at the Making of Caddyshack. Chris, before we get started talking about the movie Caddyshack and everything else, I got to know a couple things. I know you as a movie critic from Entertainment Weekly. Are you a golfer? Are you a sports fan?
I'm a huge sports fan, although my golf game is pretty weak. Not as bad as Rodney Dangerfield's in Caddyshack, but still not good.
Yeah, we'll get to the golf games of the cast coming up here in just a few minutes. So were you, and this is even weirder, because you're a film critic, I know that if the movie Caddyshack comes out right now, like every other critic, you're going to give it reviews that rival a Spinal Tap album. You're going to crush this movie, but yet, obviously, it's in your pantheon of guilty pleasures for you to take the time to write about it.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, when you tell people that you're a movie critic, they always think that your favorite movie is going to be like Citizen Kane or Vertigo or some Ingmar Bergman film from Sweden. But the fact of the matter is, when I was growing up, the movies that I was raised on were Animal House and Stripes and Caddyshack and Vacation. So those are the movies that are probably the closest to my heart.
Well, it sort of reminded me of, I love the story of the late Gene Siskel. And not that Saturday Night Live wasn't a critical success, but it was, or not Saturday Night, Saturday Night Fever. But he owned and bid on and paid big money, and he actually owned the John Travolta suit from Saturday Night Fever. And I thought, that is so weird. But, you know, everybody has their favorites.
Yeah, I mean, you know, us critics, we're fans. Highbrow, lowbrow, whatever it is, there are certain movies that just connect to you. And for me, I don't own any Caddyshack memorabilia, but it is a dear movie to me.
Chris Nashawaty is the author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. He's our guest taking dead aim. Before we can talk about Caddyshack or the movie that begat it, if you will, Animal House, it's important that we recognize and talk about a guy named Doug Kenny. He is a good portion of the first half of your book. You can make an argument. Now, the name might ring a bell. Doug Kenny was the character of Stork in Animal House, the guy who led the band down the alley, if you're having trouble remembering the character. You can make an argument, and I think you made a pretty good one in your book, that Doug Kenny is actually sort of the godfather of contemporary American comedy.
I couldn't put that better myself. In fact, I wish I had that phrase when I was writing the book. Doug Kenny is a fascinating guy. And, you know, even when you talk to people like Chevy Chase and Bill Murray and you ask them who the funniest person they've ever known is, they, to a man, say Doug Kenny. He started at the Harvard Lampoon when he was going to school there, and he started the National Lampoon in 1970, which became, you know, sort of this real publishing sensation across between like Mad Magazine and the New Yorker, if you can imagine that. And then he wrote Animal House, and then he wrote Caddyshack. I mean, the run of comedy that he was on in the 70s was remarkable.
Yeah, I made a list here. You brought up Harvard Lampoon. That begat National Lampoon. You can make an argument that that begat Saturday Night Live, which begat Animal House, the Blues Brothers, and Caddyshack. And the guy at the beginning of all this and in the middle of all of it was Doug Kenny.
Absolutely. Yep, he is ground zero for this for that generation of comedy, he is the man that, you know, not enough people know, but they certainly know his work if they don't know his name.
One other thing I want to touch on, we've mentioned it a couple of times before we get to Caddyshack, is you have to mention Animal House. Everybody loves Animal House. We all know the lines. We all repeat them. I had no idea what a groundbreaking comedy it actually was, that for a time it was the biggest money-making comedy in the history of American film. I think it was made for a budget of like $4 million, and in 1977 or whatever it was, it made $128 million. And to put that in math terms for you, that's so much money that Hollywood couldn't hide it, and they had to pay the writers points. And Hollywood never does that.
No, it's true. They joke that Hollywood accounting is, you know, designed so that you never see any more money after your original payday. But they could not hide the money that movie made. It's, you know, it was something new in comedy. It was subversive and satiric, and it took no prisoners. And it coming on the wake of something like Smokey and the Bandit, or, you know, George Burns as God and Oh God, or, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, palling around with an orangutan in those monkey movies he made in the 70s. This was something that was a total breath of fresh air and wasn't afraid to break a little bit of China in the process.
Chris Nashawaty is the author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, let's get to Caddyshack, and let's start with some of the casting. Now we look at the cast, and they're Mount Rushmore-esque. But back in the day, let's sort of explain who everybody was at the time. Let's start with Rodney Dangerfield. Who was he in 1979?
Yeah, you know, Rodney has a really interesting backstory. You know, he had started off in the 60s as a comedian, in the 50s actually as a comedian, and his career never really took off. You could argue that he was a little bit ahead of his time, but he had to give it up, and he became an aluminum siding salesman, and eventually started to go back to comedy in the 60s, where he started to finally catch fire. And then, before Caddyshack, he had been on this really volcanic run of performances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And every time he was on stage, he would just leave people, you know, just sobbing, crying, because he was so funny. And when he was cast in Caddyshack, even though he hadn't really been in any movies before and didn't know how movies were made, they were considering Don Rickles. But Dangerfield was so hot in The Tonight Show, they decided to go with him.
It's important to point out to so many who have never lived at a time where they didn't have 400 channels on their TV, just how big a deal it was to kill on The Tonight Show. Johnny Carson, every night when there were three networks and later four networks, he had a captive audience of tens of millions of people, and this was a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, he was really a kingmaker. To go on Carson and to do so well that he called you over to the couch after your set as a comedian, that was like being anointed the next big star. And, you know, every stand-up comedian, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, whoever, has a story about being called over to that couch, and it's like, you know, it's Christmas, it's your bar mitzvah, it's whatever. It's just your life is never the same the next day.
Chevy Chase was one of the original Not Ready for Primetime players that opened up on Saturday Night Live during that show's first season. He became the first real breakout star in comedy. When this movie was being made in 1979, reading as what you were writing, the point in his career, it reminded me of Eddie Murphy when he did 48 Hours and then Beverly Hills Cop. He was sort of at that point where he could get any movie made that he wanted as long as he was the star.
That's actually a perfect comparison, Eddie Murphy. Chevy Chase was the only character in the cast in the first season of SNL who not only was featured in a way that the others weren't, but he would actually say his name on TV. You know, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not, when he was doing Weekend Update. And he was pretty savvy about that. He knew that that was a way to turn himself into a household name. And he really popped on that show. And when he left after the first season to have a movie career, the cast members who were left behind, you know, Belushi and Aykroyd, all those guys, were a little resentful that he had left. And when Bill Murray replaced him, he was sort of became the Avenger in a way. When Chevy came back to guest host in 1978, he and Bill Murray got in a fist fight because as the new guy, Bill Murray felt like he had to stand up for the cast members. And that led to a lot of tension that a lot of people feared would play out again on the set of Caddyshack.
There's a memorable scene in Caddyshack where that tension gets taken care of. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. Chris Nashawaty, author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story, is our guest taking Dead Aim. Two more pieces of casting that I thought were interesting in your book. One, we all knew Ted Knight as Ted Baxter on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. The fact that he only won two Emmys, being nominated, I think you wrote six times, is stunning to me because he was perfect on that show. And he was hysterical in Too Close for Comfort. What I was totally unaware of was Ted Knight's military background. That was stunning to me. I had to read that twice.
Yeah, I mean, Ted Knight had lived such a life before he even became an actor. As you mentioned, he was a World War II hero. He was on the front lines, awarded multiple times, and he had been a ventriloquist in Providence. You know, he did kiddie shows. He did everything before Mary Tyler Moore came along. And he had a little bit of trouble with the wild and crazy cast in the set of Caddyshack, who were, they were all improvisers who would make up their own lines and not stick to the script. And Ted was a professionally trained actor who thought that, you come to the set every day knowing your lines, and that's what you do. And it drove him kind of crazy. And I think a lot of the rage that he had, especially with Rodney, who was just making up stuff left and right, that played really well for his character, Judge Smales.
It's hard to imagine anyone other than Michael O'Keefe playing Danny Noonan. But someone who was really close to getting the part, and this is going to be even wilder, was Mickey Rourke. I can't picture it would have been so much darker of a character. Can you imagine brooding Danny Noonan?
It really did come down to those two, and it was a bit of a toss-up. They went with O'Keefe because he was a better golfer. But, yeah, I mean, Mickey Rourke is a pretty, pretty intense dude. It's not a wacky comedy with Mickey Rourke as Danny Noonan by a long shot.
The genesis for the idea of the movie Caddyshack did not come from Doug Kenny or Harold Ramis or anyone else who pitched it in Hollywood. It came from a guy named Murray, but not the Murray we've talked about.
Yeah, Brian Doyle Murray was the third writer with Doug Kenny and Harold Ramis. And the story was really his. And it was a very personal story because the Murray boys, well, there were nine Murray kids in all. And they were a working class family in a pretty ritzy neighborhood just north of Chicago. And in order to pay for Jesuit school, their father made them work as caddies and shag boys during the summer so they could pay tuition. And when you're a caddy and a shag boy, you come up with a lot of crazy stories and you meet a lot of colorful characters. And so when it was time to pitch the follow-up to Animal House, they went back to Brian and they said, tell us more about this Caddyshack idea. And that's what they pitched. And it's a very personal story to the Murray family.
That's Chris Nashawaty. And when we return, more on his book that takes dead aim at the making of the most beloved golf movie of all time, Caddyshack. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Hey, we're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, more with Chris Nashawaty and his book on the making of Caddyshack. You can't think of Caddyshack at all without thinking of the other Murray, and that's Bill Murray as Carl, the greenskeeper, or the assistant greenskeeper, excuse me, in Caddyshack. But when the camera started rolling, the character wasn't even fleshed out. It wasn't even in the first two or three drafts of the script when Bill actually showed up on set, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Carl Spackler was a complete afterthought. The studio wanted one more star in the movie, and Brian obviously thought of his brother Bill, who at the time was just starting to take off on Saturday Night Live. So they got Bill to come and do it, but the character was such an afterthought that they hadn't written any lines for him. But knowing what a great improviser Bill was, you know, with his training at Second City in Chicago and on Saturday Night Live, they just knew that if they just left some blank pages for his scenes, he would appear on the set, they'd roll the camera, and he'd come up with gold, which is exactly what he did, because that Cinderella story scene that he does, that's in one take, and that's all ad-libbed.
Let's talk about improvisation and ad-libbing, because I don't think it's done nearly as much today in film as it used to be. And maybe it's a gap in talent that doesn't exist out there, or that Hollywood doesn't allow it to happen. I don't know. But I'm going to give you a list of scenes just in Animal House and Caddyshack that I know were improvised, and they're some of the most famous scenes in the world. You have Belushi on the stairs with Stephen Bishop smashing the guitar in Animal House. You have the whole cafeteria scene with Belushi and look at me, I'm a zit. Okay, you have Bill Murray doing the Cinderella story, and I want to talk about this scene now where you have Bill Murray and Chevy Chase in Carl's shack where he's growing a breed of grass that you can play on and smoke. All of these scenes, 100% improv, just with a premise given. That's amazing. Those are some of the biggest scenes in the history of comedy.
It is amazing. And I think the reason why they don't do it anymore, I think there are some actors who still do it a little bit, someone like Will Ferrell, you know, and some of the Judd Apatow comedies, they do a little improv. But movies have become so expensive now, and they're such huge investments, that no one is going to risk that kind of money on going into a film without a script. But back in 1979, when they were making Caddyshack, you know, we had a first-time director, a first-time producer, stars that weren't really hadn't been in movies before, and the movie didn't cost all that much. It cost $6 million, and so they just let these guys, since they were coming off Animal House and hoping for another Animal House, do whatever the hell they wanted, and that's what they did, and they just miraculously spun it into gold.
The book is Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Author Chris Nashawaty is our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Just a quick aside, one more piece of casting that I had written down here that when I read it, I laughed out loud. For those of us who grew up and came of age in the late 70s and early 80s and remember the memorable jingles and TV commercials, when I saw this on the page and then I remembered the face, I laughed out loud. Tell everybody who Dr. Beeper was better known as on television.
Dr. Beeper was played by an actor named Dan Rezin, who was a sort of a jobbing, struggling actor whose previous claim to fame was as the Tidy Bowl Man.
Unbelievable! He was the Tidy Bowl Man in the boat in the toilet.
Perfect.
It was fantastic. Hey, as a member of Rolling Hills Country Club, legit, Rolling Hills Country Club in Monroe here in Charlotte, it pleased me to no end to see that same name for the club used as Bushwood. Does the club still exist?
It does. And now they have a different name now. It's called Grand Oaks. So you may be the only Rolling Hills now. But, yeah, it was Rolling Hills in Davie, Florida, and they originally wanted to shoot it in Illinois because the Murrays were from Illinois, and that's where they sort of envisioned it. But, you know, when they decided that they were going to shoot it in the fall, you can't really make a breezy summer comedy by Lake Michigan in the fall. So they went down to Florida and found this course that fortunately didn't have many palm trees and sort of looked like it could pass for Illinois, and they proceeded to just devastate the place, you know, with that giant explosion at the end of the film.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I've always wondered how in the hell they talked a club into letting them blow it up. Because this is the late 70s. We're not in the computer-generated age of creating explosions out of thin air. There was real dirt and pyrotechnics being used at a country club. How did they convince the club to let them do this?
One simple answer: they didn't tell them. Obviously they showed you know, the board of Rolling Hills in Florida the script, and the explosion was in the script, and the board said, look, you know, if you're going to do this movie here, you have to change the script. And they said, oh no, don't worry, the script will be changing. But what they didn't tell them is that part of the script wasn't going to be changing. So on the day of the explosion, one of the producers took all of the board members from the club out to lunch, lured them off campus, and then they just, while the mice was away, the cow was away, they just blew the whole thing up, And it was such a huge explosion. They were in the flight path to the Fort Lauderdale airport. An incoming plane radioed into the control tower that there had been a plane crash.
The very first scene filmed for Caddyshack would become one of the most famous scenes in the movie, yet the way it was filmed on day one never saw the light of day. Sort of explain what I'm talking about.
I think you're talking about the Dalai Lama scene?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So the Dalai Lama scene, there's a very not funny version of that speech in the script. And they gave it to this actor who was just sort of this local Florida guy who was a war veteran and, frankly, a little bit off and not in a funny way. And when he tried to do the scene, he just couldn't do it. And Harold Ramis, the director, thought, geez, you know, this is the first day, and I know I'm going to get fired when they see this thing back in Hollywood. So they decided to just move on, get rid of this guy, and they figured when Bill Murray showed up, they would just give the scene to him, and they did, and he just turned it into something that's like poetry.
You mentioned Rodney Dangerfield, and he is Al Chervik. He's unbelievable. His very first scene that they filmed was the infamous pro shop scene. Rodney being used to being on stage and getting laughs, this almost seems sort of foreign because you think of the consummate performers being in front of cameras all the time, but I guess this really wasn't the case. Rodney thought that scene, in which he killed, by the way, he thought that he was bombing over and over again. Why?
Well, I think most stand-up comedians have a slightly neurotic edge and are a little bit insecure. But, yeah, Rodney was not familiar with how movies are made. And so he's out there giving it his all, making jokes, some that are in the script, some that aren't. You buy a hat like this, I bet you get a free bowl of soup, all that. He's doing that. And he realizes that no one's laughing. And he's like, I am tanking here. What's going on? And he was really insecure about it. And they finally had to pull him aside and say, no, Rodney, you're doing great. The problem isn't that people aren't laughing. It's that we can't laugh because we'll ruin the take if you hear the crew laughing, on film. So it took him a while to get the hang of things. He didn't even know what the word action meant to start the scene. Eventually they just had to call out, Rodney, do your bit, instead of action at the beginning of all of his scenes.
You mentioned the bowl of soup line. Yet another completely improvised line that's one of the most famous in American comedy. Chris Nashawaty, our guest, Taking Dead Aim, author of the book Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Want to talk real briefly about the dynamic between Ted Knight and Rodney Dangerfield. We touched on this earlier. Ted Knight, the consummate, coming from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, the ensemble, the script is the Bible sort of actor, and Rodney, who's completely off the cuff, and the anger we saw on screen from Ted Knight's character, Judge Smales, that may not have taken much acting on his part.
No, I mean, he really was upset with the way that everyone else on the movie was making the movie. It just went against everything he knew about acting. And not only that, but, you know, Ted Knight was older than most of the cast and the crew, who were young and fun and in their 20s and looking to have a good time. And they were in Florida in 1979, which is pretty much the gateway into the country for cocaine. So there's a lot of drug taking on this set, and Ted just wasn't having it. So, Rodney just sort of saying whatever the heck popped into his head just went against everything that Ted believed in, and he had trouble keeping up. So when you see him just seething in those scenes, it's just, that's what we call method rage.
Get you out of here on this, and this goes to you as a film critic. I was just, as we were talking, trying to think of comedies in the last 10 to 12 years. Big successful ones, maybe The Wedding Crashers, maybe the first Hangover movie. Those are ones that really made me laugh out loud. I don't quote those movies. I don't have their quotes memorized. What is it about these comedies, other than the fact that Bill Murray was in them? You know, Stripes, Meatballs, Caddyshack. I know Bill wasn't in Animal House, but I'm going to throw that in there too. What is it about those movies, those comedies, the Blues Brothers from, 79 to 82? What is it that resonates even to this day with people that they memorize lines and know them, and it doesn't happen today?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have the answer. I have a couple of theories. The first is that it's like the NBA. You know, as great as everyone is, as many star players as there are, there isn't a Jordan, a Magic, a Bird. You know what I mean? Yes, there's LeBron, but it just seems like the stars were better back in the day. And with the movies, you know, I'd argue that there, you know, a movie like Anchorman or the Austin Powers movies are pretty quotable, but my God, it seemed like there was one coming out every week back in the 70s and 80s. And I just think that those movies, they knew how to make comedies better back then.
Oh, and one more little thing. We talked real quick about the Dalai Lama scene. The poor child who had the pitchfork shoved in his chest for about 7 hours once Bill Murray got there and started filming it was a guy named Peter Burkrot. Now, if I were to ask you what Peter Burkrot is doing today, specifically that has to do with your book, what would you say?
I would say that young man who had a pitchfork aimed at his throat for about 7 hours with Bill Murray, he now reads audiobooks at Audible, and he read the audiobook for Caddyshack, The Making of a Cinderella Story.
The book is Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. That's author Chris Nashawaty. I'd also like to thank former Big Break contestants Will Lowry and Christian Heavens for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered? No worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts. It will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Weather-wise, well, guess what? It's July in the Carolinas, so it's hot. And you may have to dodge a shower or two, but it's still perfect to get your golf on this weekend. And if you do tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.